10. Stephen Parker failed to stifle a bone-deep yawn as he passed by the duty officer at the front desk of Albany Street Police Station. The barrel-chested man behind the high counter saw him and chuckled.
Rough night, Detective Sergeant.
Long night, Mike, he corrected.
I thought you could run all hours.
The duty officer looked him up and down, taking in Parker's sturdy build and his round, serious face. He shook his head.
Get a wife and a kid, and you'll see how long that lasts you.
He gave a weak grin. Later. Outside, London's morning sky was low and grey, and it threatened drizzle. He blew out a breath and marched against the flow of commuters coming up the pavement, making his way to the side street where he'd left his car. Parker was far enough down the pecking order at Albany Nick to ensure that he didn't get a proper parking space to call his own, and his nondescript four-door Ford sat against the curb, misted with condensation. He slowed as he approached the vehicle, something in his copper's intuition ringing a warning bell. Without making it obvious, he scanned the street, but saw nothing that gave him pause. He blinked and sighed. After everything that had happened in the last few days, he was jumping at shadows. Right now, more than anything, Stephen wanted to be home with his wife and young son. If the traffic was with him, he might be able to make it back before Kate took little Matthew to nursery. Parker was reaching for the door handle when he glimpsed movement from the corner of his eye. He turned, immediately presenting himself side-on in case of an assault. But what he saw was a gangly figure, garbed in rough clothes, lifting up off a square of soiled cardboard. The homeless man had been concealed in the mouth of a narrow alleyway.
"Oi, mate,"
said the man, raising his fingers to his lips like he was holding an invisible cigarette.
"Spare a fag?"
"Don't smoke," Parker replied, his tone hardening. "Jog on, fella."
The vagrant kept his head down, dragging a heavy backpack over one shoulder. His voice shifted.
"Kate made you quit, didn't she?"
Mark Dane peeked up at him from under the bill of a threadbare baseball cap, and Parker froze. When he replied, his voice was low and hostile. "I haven't seen you. I don't want to see you. Do yourself a favor and get lost." He turned his back and opened the car door.
"I need some help, Steve."
Parker stopped and cursed himself.
"This is a mistake," said a voice in his thoughts. "Just drive on, leave him be."
He wanted very much to do that, to go home and never tell Kate that he had seen her brother again. But even as that thought formed in his mind, he knew he wouldn't.
"Get in the back seat and keep your head down," he said in a flat tone.
"Don't talk." He drove a few streets away until he came to a housing estate where traffic was light and parked in a lay-by. Resting one hand on the pepper spray he kept on a belt clip, Parker turned in his seat and glared at the man sitting behind him.
"Steve, thanks."
He silenced Mark before he could say more with a grave shake of the head.
"You've got brass balls turning up like this," he growled. "No bloody sign of you for over a year, and then you come to me on the street."
"I'm sorry,"
Mark said, looking out through the windows like he was being hunted.
"But you're the only one I could talk to."
Parker's fists clenched with the echo of old anger. He was thinking of how he had watched his wife cry after the last time Mark had spoken to them, of the impotent fury he had felt at his brother-in-law. The two men had been civil to one another for Kate's sake, but Parker had never been able to connect with Mark, finding him hard work, distant. After the passing of Kate's mother, the rift had grown wider. Mark hadn't been there at the funeral. They said he had been on operational duty. And in the aftermath, the two siblings had fallen out. He didn't exactly know what it was that Mark Dane did for the government, but he was a copper, and he knew the players in the City of London. It wasn't hard to hazard a guess.
"I told you I never wanted you to bring your spook shit to my door."
The day before, men in suits who made vague assurances of being from the security services had come to question Parker and his wife, pressing them for any information about Mark's whereabouts. They had not been subtle with their threats about the consequences if things were kept from them.
"Wells," Mark said, almost to himself. Victor Wells. I don't know what you're mixed up with, Parker told him. I don't want to know. The only reason I haven't already dragged you into the nick is because Kate loves you, as much as you've upset her, and I love my wife. Mark was silent for a long time. I'm sorry, he said at length, and Parker knew he meant it. I never wanted that to happen. He sank back in the driver's seat and felt a wave of weariness engulf him. You've pissed off some very important people, Mark. They told us that you're implicated in serious crimes, murder and treason. That's a bloody lie, Mark spat. He stopped and took a moment to gather himself. Look, I'm going to make this right. I'm not in the wrong here. Parker was a good detective, and the one skill he truly prided himself on was the ability to detect a lie when he heard it. Mark was not lying to him, and for all the differences between them, he had never considered his brother-in-law to be a criminal. On some level, he understood about the funeral. Kate hadn't wanted to hear it, so he kept it to himself. But Parker knew that the requirements of duty often failed to account for the small human needs of people. He'd seen the flowers Mark left at the grave where his mother was buried. Parker released a long, slow sigh. What do you want, Mark? The answer took a while coming. I have to get out of the country, and I have to do it in the next 24 hours. Otherwise, they're going to catch up to me, and I'll end up buried in some Welsh peat bog. You need money, is that it? He shook his head. I need papers. Passport, driver's license, a clean skin. Parker frowned. I can't get you that. I bet you know a man who can. He gave Mark a sharp look. You understand what you're asking for, right? You're making me an accomplice to international flight. They'll put me inside for that. Kate and Matty, they won't have anything if I get pinched. Help me with this, and I am gone, Mark told him. It won't connect back to you. I won't put my sister's family in danger. He trailed off. She's all I have now. After a moment, Parker pulled out the flat black notebook he kept in his coat pocket and scribbled down a few words. You'll need to be quick, he said, as he wrote. Immigration is going to smash this place flat in a couple of days. He tore out the page and handed it to Mark, who took it like it was the ticket to his freedom. Thank you, said Mark. And look, Kate, can you tell her? Parker turned his back on him. I'm not going to tell her anything. Not that I saw you or talked to you or even got a sniff of you, but if your MI6 mates come back to my home and they put you on the line over my family, I will give you up without even a second's hesitation. Do you get me? Yeah, Mark said quietly. Yeah, I do. He opened the door and took a last look around before climbing out. One more thing. Parker glanced at him in the rearview mirror. If you really are a traitor, Mark, never come back. When the door slammed, he started the car and drove away, eyes fixed on the road ahead. The Ford sped off, leaving the unkempt man on the street watching it go. Neither the driver nor the passenger had seen the silver Nissan sedan that had shadowed them from Albany Street. The woman in the driver's seat put the Nissan in gear, ready to pull out. Target's moving again. Do we stay on it? She had a severe look about her, a tight face beneath short brown hair. Her companion's expression was fixed in a glower, his face swollen around the bandage over his broken nose. No, we stay with the primary. Are we sure that's him? The other man nodded once. I'm sure. After the incident at Waterloo, he wasn't going to forget Mark Dane's face in a hurry. Without taking his eyes off his subject, he drew his smartphone and hit a speed dial key. Alpha One, said Victor Wells. Report. Echo team on the brother-in-law, he replied. We have a sighting of the primary. Request permission to isolate and extract. No, said Wells. The scrambler on the line made his voice sound tinny and distant. I know you owe him a slap, but rein it in. Your orders are to track, but not to engage. Is that clear? The man with the broken nose shared a look with his partner, and she shrugged. We're not going to reel him in, sir. Now Dane is out, I want him to think he's cleverer than the rest of us. Let him get complacent. See where he leads us. He can't be in this alone.
To confirm, said the gruff, mechanical voice inside Lucy's helmet. Echo team are to track but not apprehend primary. She heard the burble of a reply, but it was too faint for her to decipher. She leaned forward over the handlebars of the black Ducati 848, her face invisible behind the cowl of her visor. A wireless link between the helmet speakers and the ultraviolet laser microphone rig in her hand passed the sounds of the voices inside the Nissan into something she could understand. The laser mic looked like a bulky flashlight, the invisible beam it generated bouncing off the passenger side window of the Nissan and reflecting back to a sensor that registered the smallest of perturbations in the laser's wavelength. Onboard software turned the vibrations back into audio, allowing Lucy to remotely bug the MI6 team from her perch on the motorcycle 100 meters away. She smiled. Keyes liked the irony of conducting surveillance on a surveillance unit. Her instincts had been good, like they always were. Dane had made contact with the one person who, according to the file Solomon's connections had delivered, was the least likely choice.
Smart boy, she said to herself, go to the guy who likes you the least.
But Dane hadn't been smart enough. What he could think of, so could MI6, and so could Rubicon. It was a play a more seasoned field operative would never have made. The Nissan pulled out and rolled away into traffic. Lucy gave a count of 10 and then fired up the bike. Stepping off the bus with his collar up, Mark avoided the main road, where he might have been caught on a CCTV camera, and skirted the edge of Burgess Park until he found his way down the side streets to the vacant residential blocks of the Aylesbury estate. The folded slip of paper in his pocket bore the address of a flat in one of the main structures of the complex, a crumbling series of neo-brutalist concrete blocks. Much of the site was derelict now, with a handful of die-hard residents still living among hundreds more empty apartments. The place was mired in the slow process of preparation for demolition and future gentrification, and in among the boarded-up flats, there were ideal spaces for a forger to set up shop. He followed the long, narrow terraces past lines of tin security panels, bolted over windows and doorframes, passing down ghost town walkways where wind-blown leaves collected in the sharp-angled corners. The estate was sparse, almost beyond abandoned, empty even of squatters or the more usual low-end criminal wildlife, nothing more than hollow shells sealed tight and left to wait for the eventual march of bulldozers and wrecking balls. The rain started, hard threads of it falling at angles that clattered against acres of grimy windows. Mark jogged across the overgrown grass verge outside the block he was looking for and found the entry door on the ground floor, propped open by a brick. Inside, the air was stale. Haphazard graffiti marked the brown tile of the walls. He climbed the stairs, catching the smell of cigarette smoke and the low mutter of conversation from upstairs. Schooling his expression, Mark walked calmly onto the landing and found two teenagers blocking his path. They eyed him, lazy and feral. "Here to do business," he told them. To show willing, Mark peeled off a £10 note and paid his toll to pass. Another doorstop met him on the next floor up, outside the flat, but this one had a lot more threat about it. He was a heavy-set Asian man, a Sikh, in a dark blue tracksuit that did nothing to conceal the obvious bulge at the waist where a fat revolver was holstered. Mark gave the Sikh the Glock without complaint and submitted to a pat-down. Then he was in through the door, and the first thing that hit him was the smell of cooked lamb. His mouth flooded with saliva, and there was an answering rumble from his stomach. Only the living room and the kitchen of the apartment were occupied. The rest of the flat was vacant, emptied down to the wallpaper. The smell came from a young man working at a camping stove, who threw Mark a slow, disinterested look as he peered into the room in passing. The forger was an older man, with skin the color of weathered teak and salt-and-pepper hair. He rolled toward him, across the concrete floor on a chair mounted on casters, and gave Mark a level look. "What service can I offer you?" he asked, with a politeness that seemed incongruous. Mark took in the dining table before him, piled high with carefully ordered suitcases, each filled with blank paperwork and unused official documents. He spotted a high-definition laser printer, digital cameras and a portable computer setup that looked more suitable for a corporate office than this decrepit domestic setting. "The full set," he said. "Passport, driver's license, identity card." "I have German, Czech, Canadian, and Belgian." He nodded. "German." "2 days," said the old man. Mark shook his head. "No." He dropped his backpack onto the bare floor and fished out the counterfeit IDs Sam Green had prepared for herself. "I'll give you these as a sweetener." The forger took them and flipped through the documents. He made an appreciative noise, admiring the workmanship. "I can offer a recycling discount for this lot, but still, 48 hours. "How much for right now?" Mark insisted. "You're in a hurry." "Everyone is in a hurry these days." "I don't disagree, but I still need this now." £4,000. It had to be twice the going rate. But Mark had no time to quibble. He returned to the backpack and laid a thick wedge of 50s on the table. "Half now, half when you're done. I'll wait," he told the old man, wandering into the kitchen. Mark helped himself to a little of the Rogan Josh in the cookpot and found a corner of the flat where he could eat in silence. The Nissan's lights flashed once as a panel van slowed to a halt and parked in front of it. The rain was a steady drumming on the roof of the sedan, a dull and monotonous sound that only served to help erode the man's patience. He looked up as a figure jogged back across the road from the shadow of the housing estate and opened the door. The severe-looking woman climbed into the driver's side and flicked rainwater off her coat. "Took a while, but I found him. He went into one of the blocks," she reported. "There's a couple of louts in there, maybe some more." He nodded. "No residents listed on the council tax database. More rats in a rat hole, then." She looked up. The rear doors of the van opened slightly, and through the crack, a group of men in black coveralls and tactical vests became visible. They carried shotguns and close assault weapons. Her partner smiled coldly. Lucy moved carefully down the length of the elevated terrace, counting off the apartments until she reached the number in her head. She had parked the Ducati near an old trash chute on one of the raised walkways, unwilling to leave the bike where it could be seen. At the right door, she halted and used the diamond-hard edge of a military combat knife to lever open the metal security panel. She made a big enough gap to slip through and forced open the door within. The apartment was damp and heavy with a musky stink of mildew, and a rotting grey-brown carpet gave under her boots as she threaded through to the back room. Cold air and trickles of rain blew in through windows that had fallen open. Lucy crouched, opening her bag, looking for a good angle. Across the grassy space, far below, was the block that Dane had disappeared into, and from this vantage point, Keyes had a view of the whole north side. She found a broken chair and used it as a prop for the Heckler & Koch PSG-1 in the long bag. Lucy calibrated her scope and peered down the length of the rifle, scanning across the balconies until she found the Sikh man. He was sitting on a stoop, smoking. Every once in a while he would scowl at the clouds, as if they were personally spiting him. The sniper panned away, turning in a tight arc until the view through the scope found the road and the silver Nissan. She had chosen a good location. Lucy could see both hunter and hunted from here. The laser microphone wouldn't work at this distance, the signal garbled by air attenuation and moisture from the rain. But she didn't need it to understand what was going on down there. The arrival of the van confirmed her suspicions. As she watched, the rear doors opened and a well-drilled line of figures in black emerged, each of them carrying weapons. A tactical unit from MI5, she guessed, called in to do the dirty work for their sister agency. One of the masked men in the assault unit crossed to speak to the surveillance team, who had exited the silver sedan. And very distinctly, Lucy saw the man with the shotgun make a throat-cutting gesture. A kill order, There was nothing else it could mean. They were going in to terminate Mark Dane, not to arrest him. But that didn't make sense. A few hours ago, MI6 had wanted him alive. Without taking her eyes from the scope, Lucy tapped the Bluetooth headset, looped over her ear, and waited for the connection. "This morning we're told to let him walk. Now he's classed as shoot on sight," said the woman. "How did that happen?" She shot a look at her colleague, who continued to scowl, then back to the assault team leader.
"Countermand," said the man with the tactical shotgun.
His voice was muffled slightly by the balaclava over his face. Only his deep-set eyes were visible, and they were as grey and cold as the rainfall.
"From higher authority at 6. Target has been reclassified." "Wells signed off on that, did he?" said the man with the broken nose.
"Not his call," said the team leader. He looked over his shoulder as one of his subordinates gave him a nod of confirmation.
"This is Delancourt."
"Put him on," said Lucy, without preamble. "We got a situation." She watched three of the men in tactical gear break off from the main group and enter one of the other residential blocks to the west. The trio all carried scoped assault rifles, short-barrel G36s by the look of them. And with quick, precise moves, they emerged on the mid-levels and took up firing posts, aiming toward the 8th floor of the other block. The guard on the stoop was totally oblivious, talking on a cell phone, making loops in the air with a lit cigarette in his hand. The rest of the tactical team disappeared out of sight, vanishing behind a line of empty garages.
"Solomon here. Lucy, what is wrong?"
She swung the scope back to the apartment where Dane had to be.
"You pay me for my professional opinion, right?" she said. "Well, my opinion is that our friend Mark Dane is going to be dead inside the next 10 minutes.
"Explain."
"I'm watching a strike team taking positions around an apartment where he's holed up. They're armed for bear."
"You're certain?"
"I know overkill when I see it."
Lucy waited for a reply, but it didn't come straight away. "Look, if you want this Brit alive, something's gonna have to be done. He won't stand a chance." As she spoke, the rest of the black-clad figures reappeared near the entrance to the building and crept inside.
"Lucy," said Solomon, his voice level and firm, "listen to me very carefully. Rubicon cannot afford to alert British intelligence to your presence there. Your operational directives remain as they were. You are to observe, but not interfere."
"This guy Dane is a techie. I count 5 roughnecks coming to his door. Those odds do not favor him."
"I am aware," came the reply,
and she heard the frustration under his tone.
"Report in when... when events have reached a conclusion."
The signal cut and Lucy frowned. She tightened the focus on the PSG-1's scope and caught sight of something moving behind the metal security slats of the apartment.
"You better be lucky, pal," she said to the air.
"Lucky or smart."
The forger was good. He had to give the man that. Mark had resigned himself to waiting out the night in the grim confines of the dingy flat, but in less than 3 hours the work had been done. Mark's glum, weary expression looked back up at him from the photo page of a German Reispass.
"Complete with holographic foil," said the old man, placing a pencil behind his ear. He rotated on his chair. "Impressive, yes?"
"Yes," agreed Mark.
It chilled him to think that for a bag of cash, any self-styled troublemaker with an axe to grind could do what he had.
Marco Stahl. He tried the new name on for size, saying it a few times to find the right inflection.
"Ja, ich heiße Marco Stahl."
"Sehr gut,"
said the forger, with a flat smile that didn't reach his eyes.
"So then, the balance of your fee, if you please."
He held out his hand. Very suddenly, Mark became aware of the big Sikh standing in the corridor behind him.
his tracksuit top unzipped and the thumb of his meaty brown paw resting on the elastic loop of his trousers close to the butt of the revolver.
"Pleasure doing business with you,"
Mark lied, carefully weighing out wads of notes in bundles of 500 from the depths of his backpack. The old man took the money and the false warmth in his face faded.
"There's also the bill for the curry my grandson cooked."
Mark tensed.
"And how much is that?"
The revolver emerged.
"How much you got in there?"
The Sikh spoke for the first time, snarling the words. Behind him, the boy, the grandson, made his way toward the front door, a flashlight in his hand, his head bobbing as he peeked through the tin slats. Mark frowned.
"You gonna roll me? I thought we were doing business here."
"You'll get what you pay for," said the forger, unsmiling. "I have standards, but it strikes me that someone in a hurry has little choice about making additional..."
Whatever thin justification the old man was going to give him was broken by the sound of the front door opening and a sudden, brutal crash of gunfire. The grandson came spinning back down the short hallway as if he'd been kicked by a horse and crumpled into a heap with an ugly red bloom growing large across his chest. The front door swung open, and the big Sikh was already turning, swearing under his breath, bringing up the revolver. Outside, across the way, Mark saw a flicker of yellow-white flashes in the rainy gloom and threw himself at the ground. The air sang as rifle rounds cut across the gap between the apartment blocks and tore into the forger's bodyguard, the walls, and the doorframe. The revolver gave off a sound like thunder as the Sikh jerked the trigger in his death throes. The noise reverberated, and it was a signal for the rain to come down. Suddenly, a salvo of silenced assault rifles out there were discharging, ripping through the tin casements over the windows and shattering the glass behind them, driving holes into the fiberboard walls, smashing the forger's expensive computer gear. The naked light bulb overhead fragmented, plunging the space into grey shadow. Mark rolled over onto his back as the room hazed with plaster dust, scanning for another exit. He came face to face with the blunt barrel of his Glock semi-automatic gripped in the old man's hands.
"You brought this upon us," he spat. "Son of a whore."
For the second time, the forger's words were interrupted, but this time it was the wasp buzz of a stray round that silenced him once and for all. The shot met his face just inside the orbit of his right eye and punched a divot of brain matter and bone out the back of his skull. The old man's legs gave out and he collapsed, falling back into his wheeled chair with a grunt of expelled air. The Glock clattered to the floor and Mark scrambled toward it, staying low, snagging it with his outstretched fingers. The cascade of bullets halted as suddenly as it had started, and he strained to listen over the sound of his blood rumbling in his ears. Mark caught the scrape of boots against concrete out on the walkway coming closer. There would be a second team, he reasoned. A shooter unit dialed in to soften up the target, and an approach unit to go in and neutralize any survivors. Mark felt sick, and suddenly the meat in his stomach wanted out again. He swallowed hard, tasting bile in his mouth. He knew this kind of operation by heart. How many times had he and Leon and Owen sat in the van and directed the same mission profile? Only this time, he was experiencing it from the sharp end. Was there someone just like him down there? Out of sight in the back of a truck, watching a grainy video feed and directing a squad of killers? He shook off the thought and tried to calm his breathing. If he knew the play they were making, then he could figure out how to avoid it. Mark looked back toward the kitchen, where a door led out to a narrow balcony. Someone would be covering the rear of the building, that was a given. But if he could give them something else to think about, there was a chance he could create a gap he could escape through. They would expect him to go down, to head for the ground floor and make a break for it through the front door. He turned back and saw the forger's corpse lolling in the wheeled office chair. Drawing up his leg, Mark kicked out with a short, sharp motion and struck the frame of the chair. The blow sent it spinning and moving, describing a curving pirouette as it trundled away from him, casters rattling over the concrete floor. The chair and the slump body sailed right past the line of the damaged windows, providing the shooters outside with a moving target. Immediately, the heavy coughs of shotgun discharges sounded, bracketing the dead man. Each impact made the chair spin and judder, showing the gunman on the walkway the illusion of life.
Mark was already in a crouching run, heading back toward the kitchen. He fired blindly into the ceiling of the living room as he ran, to prolong the pretense. Metallic objects tumbled through the broken windows and clanked against the walls behind him. He didn't look back. He knew the sound, and ducked low under the kitchen table, eyes screwed shut, mouth open, and the heels of his hands pressed into his ears. A heartbeat later, the flashbangs went off with a flare of brilliant white fury, and Mark's nostrils stung with a hot discharge of chemical smoke. Even a room away from the stunned grenade explosions, he was still dazzled and partly deafened. Blindly, Mark rose up under the table, carrying it with him, throwing its contents and all at the whitewashed windows. Glass shattered onto the balcony. He found the dented camping stove where it had fallen and slammed the valve joint against the wall. Propane under pressure hissed back at him from the new break in the nozzle, and Mark rolled it away, back down the hallway, like a bowling ball. A figure in black, face hidden behind a scowling filter mask and ballistic helmet, appeared in the open doorway with a shotgun at the ready. The armed man saw Mark moving and fired at him without hesitating. He was at the broken back window, as the sparks from the shot ignited the propane, and a hot blast of fire channeled down the flat's narrow hallway. A plug of smoke and flame slammed Mark in the back, shoving him out onto the balcony. He heard the man with the shotgun scream. Fighting down the trembling rush of adrenaline in his hands, he swung across the meter-wide gap to the foot of the next balcony along. They were staggered, one raised slightly higher than the next. Mark scrambled up past the 9th and 10th floors until he reached the lip of the roof and dragged himself up. His hands slipped on a damp lintel covered in birdshit, but he forced his way up and over, grunting in pain as he strained a muscle in his arm. Up here, the flat roof was a maze of puddles and the low blocks of ventilator units. Mark moved away, down the top of the building, searching for a route to street level that would keep him out of sight of the kill team. At the far end of the rooftop, there were angled metal arms reaching over the sheer 10-story drop, the top of a gantry built for window cleaners to use. There might be a cable drum still up there, enough for him to play out and make it down to one of the elevated crosswalks. He went for it, low and fast, limping. Glass had cut his thigh on the way through the window and it stung like a bastard. Then, a masked figure in black stepped out in front of him from behind a lift gear shed, and Mark jerked back in shock.
"Don't you fucking move," growled the gunman,
bringing up the SD-3 submachine gun in his hands.
"You think you actually stood a chance?"
He jerked the muzzle to one side.
"Lose the gun. Put down the backpack. Hands on your head."
"So," Lucy said to the air, "not lucky then." Through the PSG-1 scope, she could see the Brit standing stock still and a sliver of the assault team operator holding him up. It was impossible to get a good look at the gunman. From her angle across the park, a cluster of vents prevented the sniper from seeing all of him. But she could fill in the blanks herself. Dane had done it again, made a risky play, and now he was paying for it. The shooter up there needed only to pitch the rogue technician off the roof, and MI6's problem would just go away. Lucy thumbed the rifle's fire selector without really being conscious of the action. Solomon's words echoed in her thoughts. "Rubicon cannot afford to alert British intelligence to your presence there." He had a very good point. But then he wasn't here, watching the last seconds of Mark Dane's life tick away. She wouldn't be on the guy now if he wasn't mission critical, and wasn't it always Solomon who told her that her skill, her judgment, was the reason he had recruited her? "Oh, shit," she sighed, and pulled the trigger. The flash and the crack of the round leaving the PSG-1's barrel was swallowed by a cylindrical suppressor, enough that someone in the room next door would only have heard the metal noise of the slide recoil. The shot crossed the distance in a fraction of a second, windage dropping it a degree, so it met meat squarely in the middle of the gunman's right calf muscle. The man was in the process of reaching up to tap his throat mic when the bullet took him down. He howled and fell to his knees. The cry shocked Mark back into motion, and he came running and kicked him hard in the chest.
The SD-3 went flying and vanished over the edge of the roof.
The fuck?
The gunman's voice was thick with pain and surprise. He twisted back to look up at Mark, and there was real fear in the eyes behind the gas mask. In his hand, Mark still had the Glock semi-automatic. Both of them knew what should happen next. The right choice, the expedient choice, was to put a bullet in this man's head and keep running. Mark kept running. 11. The thin sheeting of the ragged pergola barely served to cut the glare from the sky. Dots of sunlight marked the dust at Kadir's feet as he walked down the line of youths, each of them standing to wary attention, each of them sweating, and not from the heat. A dry wind off the Taurus Mountains rumpled the metallic fabric, making it rattle and snap. It was makeshift cover at best, enough to hide them from thermal optical cameras of drones or satellites. His gaze crossed the faces of the group, and he found the boy that had been discovered hiding in the compound. What was his name? Halil, yes. The teenager didn't look away, and Kadir gave him the faintest of nods. At his side there was a thick-set youth, still with a little puppy fat on him. Halil's companion had bruises on his face and stood awkwardly. He glanced at Jadid as he made his way back to the middle of the quad. The other men, the instructors and the guards, were all there. None of them spoke. They knew that any words today had to come first from Kadir's mouth.
"Children,"
he began, looking at his young charges.
"Children are weak and full of terror."
The commander saw their disappointment and fear. They were tense, expecting some sort of rebuke. He went on.
"For a child, the world is a place full of arbitrary rules and obstacles. It is a landscape dominated by adults, where things can be taken from you without explanation or reparation."
He walked slowly along the line once more.
"Children were brought to this place."
Kadir halted and made a point of looking each of the young ones in the eye.
"But today, I do not see them. I see men, warriors, who have left childhood behind."
A ripple of excitement passed through the assembled group. They were daring to hope now, just as he wanted them to.
"A child can do nothing. A man takes control. When a child is hurt, they cower and they weep. When a man is hurt, he takes the measure of his injury back from those who injured him."
Kadir stopped and placed a fatherly hand on the shoulder of a tall boy with short, scruffy hair. They shared a look that two equals would have given one another.
"Things have been taken from us. People we loved, our homes, the lives we lived."
His tone hardened.
"Our peace."
Some of them nodded. Others stiffened with old anger and sorrow.
"Each of you had a life crushed beneath the wheels of conflict, and you were never given a choice. But you were not broken by that experience. You were tempered, made stronger."
Kadir smiled.
"You are the best of the crop, the strongest and the most resilient, and today you are ready. Souls renewed in unity of purpose."
They responded, just as all the others had, each time he had given this speech. It was predictable. In this moment, every hardship and beating, every back-breaking hour of forced exercise and tuition was forgotten. He was giving them what the young of their age wanted: adulthood, and the liberty that came with it. He looked at them and sought the mirror of his own face as a young man, in the moment when his life had been changed. Most were the offspring of common folk, farmers and workers, the unskilled and the ordinary. They had never known the dimensions of a better life, but he had. As a boy, Kadir had grown up in a house of wealth, the scion of a military family who had served the nation of Egypt for 8 generations.
and like his brothers, his father, his uncles, he was destined to be officer class. He believed the dream, dazzled by the promise of glory. He yearned for a chest of medals and the shimmering brass buttons of the elite. But the golden patina of magnificence was a shell, a fragile skin over something rotting and decrepit. The men he respected, the mentors and elders, they had cemented their position not through prowess in battle, but by cunning in the shadows. They drank tea with sworn enemies and took coin from traitors. They laid with infidels and dogs to swell their pockets. They mocked the oath they had avowed. The precious and noble uniform he had so coveted as a child was revealed as nothing but a shroud to conceal corruption and lies. His pride, his love, all of that had crumbled into hate. He saw only greed and depravity, and a horrible stagnation of will. It shamed him to share kinship with these people. It had been a powerful moment, the day when the young Kadir had at last fully understood. He was being groomed, not for warrior status, but to maintain the status quo of a slow, immoral decay. His family and those like them were a cancer, and they were not alone. The rot infested many cities, nations, souls. But Kadir was not alone either. Others felt as he did, others who whispered in dark corners or dared to speak out. Those people became his new family, and on that day he was awakened, renewed with great purpose. His reverie ebbed away, and Kadir's tone changed, as if he were confiding a secret truth to the youths.
I envy you. You have been given such a great gift, the chance to take something from those who hurt us.
His voice hardened.
Vengeance.
Some of them muttered approval at that suggestion.
The nations of our enemies, our oppressors, the Americans and the Europeans, the Russians, even those among our own kind who would let us perish to aggrandize themselves, these are the ones who have hurt us.
He gave a solemn sigh.
A man with courage and spirit, who can look beyond fear, that kind of man cannot be stopped. He may take his revenge wherever he finds it.
He found himself in front of the boy Halil once more.
You are that man now, he told him. Each and every one of you.
The commander's gaze bored into Halil like lines of fire. The man's intensity seemed to radiate off him, and Halil was unable to respond with anything more than a wooden nod of agreement. He remembered his first thoughts of Kadir, a lion among jackals, powerful as a predator. Halil's father always had a good-natured, bright charm to him, but Kadir's charisma was something else. He burned, like dark fire, as if he were a champion out of old legends. And at that second, if Kadir had asked him to march to the gates of hell itself, Halil might well have done it. Halil could see that Taki was enraptured by the commander. He doubted that the farmer's son had ever heard anything like it, the stirring words striking a chord with all the young men beneath the canopy. The things Kadir said were right. It was an unfair world. He had been hurt, and he did want some payback for all he had lost. Some far, distant part of Halil's thoughts seemed to stand outside him and watch, detached from the events. Even as he felt himself being carried away by Kadir's speech, he wondered if the man was only saying what the youths wanted to hear, manipulating them. He was using words like a musician would play an instrument, stoking hatreds that were buried deep. Halil could not deny it. Whenever he thought of his family, the blade of sorrow that cut into him was immediately followed by a burn of fury. He wanted to make someone pay for what had been taken from him. Kadir was promising to give Halil that, and the offer was hard to resist. In his mind's eye, he saw his parents again, remembering the morning that they had died. Sorrow pulled him one way, impotent anger another. It would be so easy to succumb.
but his father's face brought with it memories of his father's words, his slow, steady delivery of stories and parables, from the Quran and from other books written by people in far-off lands. Halil remembered him talking of other men, men with bad souls, who liked to take such books and twist their meanings so others would follow them. They took words that spoke of peace and hammered them into weapons. Halil had not fully understood what his father had meant then, but the young man understood now. A chill ran through him as it became clear in his thoughts, as the last vestiges of anything approaching trust crumbled. What does Qadir want from us?
A man takes his revenge, the commander was saying.
His second brought forward a wooden crate with a hinged lid. None of the youths spoke as Jadid upended the container. A dozen wooden battens, enough for every one of them, tumbled out onto the sands. Qadir picked up one of the rods and placed it in Taki's hand. Halil watched, not daring to move. Taki had not spoken a word to him or to anyone else since the previous night. The last sound he heard from his friend had been the cries of panic coming from the shower blocks. Taki had been alone with one of the guards. No one was sure what had happened in there. Only that shouting brought other men running, and violence in their wake. Taki cried himself to sleep afterward, but in the morning his eyes were dead and distant. Jadid shouted an order, and two of the guards disappeared into an outbuilding, returning a moment later, dragging a third man between them. He was bruised and bloody, but there was no mistaking his face. Taki's shocked reaction was enough to be certain that it was the same man that had hurt him. Jadid's men threw the bloodied guard to the ground. He looked up, confusion on his face, and tried to speak, but all that escaped from his lips was a dry rattle. The commander beckoned the youths to come closer, to form a semicircle around the cowering figure. Taki and Halil were pushed forward.
"This animal walked among us," Qadir showed a sneer. "He exploited his position to indulge his baser desires. He betrayed me, and he betrayed his god. But worse than that, he betrayed you."
It began with Taki. A slow change on the boy's face, the fear melting away and something hateful reforming in its place. Halil saw his knuckles whiten around the baton. The seething anger in the other youth was like a taint, infecting all the others. The ones closest to the front of the group helped themselves to the pile of wooden sticks, and Halil knew then that it was not just his friend the errant guard had assaulted.
"Such things cannot be forgiven," the commander went on. "Such animals must be put down."
The guard was struggling to rise to his feet, a pleading look on his face. Qadir ignored him, and his gaze found Taki's. It was all the permission that the other youth required. Taki's hand blurred, and there was a sharp crack. Then the bloodied guard was staggering backwards. He shouted a curse, muffled by the hand held to his broken nose. He called Taki a motherless whore, bellowed that he would gut him like a fish. But his threats were buried in the rush as the rest of the youths went for him. Halil saw Adad snatch up a loose rock from the sand at their feet. They all beat him, screaming and yelling, and Halil was pushed along with the rest of the group, another baton pressed into his grip. They followed the man down as he tried to stagger away, the rain of blows falling again and again. Halil couldn't look away, but he could not raise the stick to strike. He heard his father's voice, the echo of his reproach warning not to do this, not to embrace the violence. The guard's face was a pulpy, swollen mess, and his arm hung limply at his side. The voices of the other orphans crowded out everything, howling and loud. Halil felt hands shoving him forward, heard the youths, spurring him on to join in. Taki's tormentor made one last effort to regain his footing and defy them. He came lurching forward at the edge of the ring formed by his attackers, straight at Halil. Hands raised like talons, he gurgled and spat, blinded by frenzy. Halil struck out before he was even aware of doing it, stabbing with the length of the baton to hit the guard in the face. The blow broke the man's jawbone and he spun, shattered teeth and pink gummy spittle drooling from his lips. Halil watched him fall once again and felt a sickly churn in his gut, suddenly aware of the speckles of warm blood spattered on his cheek. The guard dropped and did not move again. The others made certain by kicking him until finally, with a hint of pride in his voice, Kadir told them to stop. From the outside, the Monte Tauro seemed not so much a building as a carved extension of the rocky hillside. Emerging from the rough stone cliffs that fell from the coastal road above, down toward the narrow shingled beach and blue shallows, the hotel was a range of terraces formed from precise slabs of reinforced concrete that mimicked the natural grey of the rocks. The suites and rooms sat behind long, flat patios divided by circular balconies and square-cut shrubs, their wooden sun decks warming in the Sicilian afternoon. At its lowest level, the waters of a pool, ringed by ranks of loungers, shimmered in the breeze. Mark leaned over the lip of his balcony and made a slow survey of the hotel exterior. Up on the road, there was only a cobbled drive leading to what resembled an elegantly appointed blockhouse of white stone and green glass. Elevators and a spiraling staircase descended through gaps cut in the cliff, tiled corridors branching off toward the rooms. Everything in the Monte Tauro had a pared-down ethic to it, like the halls of a chic gallery or a modernist office complex. Mark liked the simplicity of the building. With all its straight corridors and glassy partitions, it was easy to see anyone coming. After all the rush and panic of the last few days, he actually felt a little safer here. Still, he closed the blackout curtains until there was only a thin column of daylight showing and retreated into the room. His luggage and the gear he had bought in the airport duty-free electronics store were scattered over the bed. So he took the wicker seat by the sliding doors and drank the rest of a bottle of tepid San Pellegrino. He worked hard to moderate his pulse, which hadn't slowed since he left the safe house. The journey seemed to take forever, each little delay mounting up as if it were about to reveal the lie of his escape. He ran a hand through his hair, and it came away dirty, fingers dulled by the spray in dye that had been part of the Marco Stahl disguise. The baseball cap he had worn on the plane from England was stained dark inside, and he frowned, tossing it into the waste bin at the end of the bed. As an afterthought, he found the American Express card he had been using for the last 12 hours and snapped it into quarters, taking care to gouge out the embedded chip. As for the growth of scruffy stubble coming in around his chin, he decided to leave it unshaven. All the better to break up the silhouette of his face. The Glock was where he had left it, concealed by the anti-detection baffles in the bottom of the go-bag. Holding it in his hand made him feel calmer, more in control, as if the cool polymer frame was leeching the dread out of him. Mark checked the rounds in the chamber, even though he didn't need to, and took stock of what he was going to do next. He was almost surprised to be here. Passing through the gauntlet of airport security, Mark had expected to be pulled from the lines of passengers. He kept looking up from the month-old copy of Wired he was pretending to read, expecting to see Victor Wells standing over him with that shit-eating smirk of his firmly in place. But then the blur of the trip ebbed, and he was in a taxi on its way out of Catania International for Taormina. And it all seemed a little surreal. Getting to where he wanted to go had slightly wrong-footed him, in point of fact. Mark allowed himself a rueful smile. So, help me, I might actually stand a chance at doing this.
He dumped his sweaty clothes and took a shower, working out as much of the hair dye as he could, burning off the travel lag with needles of hot water. By the time he was done, the sun was setting, and out in the bay beneath the town there were a few new boats gently bobbing in the tide. He fished out a pair of compact Pentax binoculars from one of the duty-free bags and went back to the window, peeling them out of their wrapping. Mark had committed the profile of the Jade to memory, and it didn't take long to find her. The yacht was out in the blue waters of the Ionian Sea, moored furthest from the shore, and as he watched, the anchor light flicked on. The boat was marble white from bow to stern, accented with emerald details and lines of black glass. It shimmered in the fading sun, resembling the closed carapace of some exotic beetle resting on the water's surface. He took a pen and made notes about what he saw. Jade was riding high, which made him wonder if the boat hadn't taken on fuel yet. He recognized the open solarium forward of the flying bridge, where Tanya Kirin had posed to take the falsely spontaneous snapshots on her social media page. It was empty now. The windows shuttered. The vessel was locked up tight, exactly what someone like Dima Novakovic would do if he were looking over his shoulder. Mark felt a faint pang of empathy for the man. "Yeah, pal. You and me both." As the evening drew in, Mark collected a room-service snack from a smiling young waiter at the door and ate on the balcony, careful to stay in the shadows cast by the open sun parasol. He watched the yacht as the air cooled, and still the Jade showed no sign of activity other than the soft glow of her interior lights. Finally, he blew out a sigh. He was putting off what he knew he had to do next. Sitting here and observing, studying the target and waiting around, that was the job that he used to have. Back then, back in the past, in the other life before Dunkirk and the shooting and the fires. It seemed like a million years ago. Mark shook it off and scowled. "Old thinking," he chided himself. "Too much note-taking and data mining. Get this done." Back in the room, he emptied the bags and arranged all the gadgets he'd picked up on the bed, making sure everything was charged and loaded. Some of the stuff was good spec. The rest was gimmick kit Mark had gathered up for just-in-case situations. He played with the recorder pen, twirling it around his fingers, considering. In the bad old days, what he had here would have been some kind of Q-branch wet dream for any intelligence officer in the field, and now it was hardware you could buy over the counter for your kids. But tech had a way of doing that, of filtering out into the real world. It was the kind of thing that gave the security agencies of the world nightmares, the idea that some ordinary civilian could amass the gear needed to do the sort of things that once had been the sole purview of governments. When it was past midnight, he took what he needed and packed it into a waterproof drawstring bag, before changing into something darker and less easy to read in Taormina's dimly lit side streets. Mark's hands slipped into the pockets of his jacket and began to drum against the lining in an aimless rhythm. He reached for the quiet spot in his thoughts, and there was something else there. It wasn't fear. It was something like that, but not so poisonous. The Glock went into a paddle holster in the small of his back, and anything that could identify him, he bundled into the day pack's hidden compartment along with his laptop. The pack would go somewhere safe. It was the one thing he couldn't afford to lose. He looked down at his watch. "Tick-tock," Mark said to the air. "Rules of engagement. Approach and isolate target." He spoke as if it were a standard op-team pre-brief, as if he was in the room with the rest of the Nomad agents, and this was a mission for all of them. "Get in and get..." He trailed off. The heavy silence of the room made it harshly clear exactly how alone he was. "Stop fucking around," Sam's voice said in his thoughts. "Green for go." "Green for go," Mark repeated and reached for the door.
It wasn't typical for such a large aircraft to wait away from the usual boarding gates, but the white and silver length of the unmarked Airbus A350 was not conventional in any sense of the word. And the Rubicon Group paid very well for their privacy. Making her way across the tarmac, Lucy pulled her overcoat around her shoulders as the wind picked up over Heathrow's flight line. Large men in black Armani suits, big as linebackers, flanked the foot of the ramp. They scanned the apron like a pair of well-dressed gun turrets, mechanical and unsmiling. The aircraft was plain and unremarkable, and that was exactly the impression it had been engineered to give. The uninspired livery was just similar enough to that of a handful of commercial carriers, so an observer at a distance could mistake it for one of them. Lucy had heard one of Solomon's ground crew say that the jet's tail registration could be changed at a moment's notice, and its onboard IFF transponder could illegally mimic any one of a number of civilian or military aircraft codes. Looking closer, there were odd blisters along the line of the dorsal and ventral hull, home to electronic countermeasures and other gear that she had no doubt was prohibited. Lucy knew for a fact that the plane had hidden launchers for infrared flares and chaff to throw off the seeker heads of air-to-air missiles. She tried not to let it bother her that Rubicon's CEO thought he needed that kind of protection for his private aircraft. At the rear of the Airbus, a cargo hatch was rising up to seal shut. She glimpsed the wheels of the Ducati and the silhouette of a larger vehicle back there as the compartment was locked. A tall, waspish figure came down the mobile staircase to meet her, his handmade shoes clacking off the metal steps. She gave Delancourt a wan smile. "Henry, pleasure as always." Solomon's assistant cut her faux compliment dead with a narrow-eyed glare. "I think it's only fair to warn you," he began, standing so he blocked her way. "You've made a mess." She shot a look at the security guards, who both continued to behave like statues deaf to their conversation. "You're such a drama queen. I kept the Brit alive. Isn't that what we wanted?" "You tipped our hand." All of a sudden, Keyes lost her patience with the French-Canadian and pushed past him, climbing the stairs. "I don't answer to you." She entered the plane and walked down to the bar lounge, looking out over the leading edge of the wing. Lucy was aware of Delancourt following close behind, but she ignored him. She was tired. Tired of running all over London looking for Mark Dane. Tired of the vague orders she had been given. Echo Solomon was there, one of the flight crew handing him a tall glass of something clear and carbonated. He gave Lucy a grave look, and she tensed. At his nod, the attendant took her bags and carried them away toward her guest room in the rear of the aircraft. Delancourt excused himself and disappeared into an office across the corridor. Without waiting to be asked, Lucy stepped behind the bar and helped herself to a shot of Booker's. "Is this the part where you dock my pay?" "Do not be flippant," Solomon replied, shutting her down hard. "The choice you made has forced me to come here and recover you. Do you understand that? There are operations that will need to go dark because of the notice you have brought to Rubicon." "Did you want Dane alive or not?" she retorted, sipping the bourbon. "If you wanted a corpse, I could have made that happen." "It is more complicated than you realize, Lucy."
"It is?" she repeated.
"Then explain it to me.
I don't work well when you decide my need to know out of hand. Can't give you my best if I'm cut out of the loop."
Solomon's jaw stiffened. He didn't like it when his employees talked back to him, but Lucy couldn't care less about that. She'd always spoken her mind.
"Your actions have drawn undue attention. British intelligence are attempting to track you as we speak. I have backstops in place to retard their investigations, but activating them has burned several key assets. And despite your unauthorized intervention today, the net result has been a loss for our efforts. Mark Dane has slipped the net. out of the country by now, offered Lucy. I would be. We have gained nothing. If anything, we have lost ground in Europe. Solomon took a step toward her. You do understand. Dane is a viable lead, right?
That got her a brief, reluctant nod of agreement.
So better he's still breathing than not. You know what happened back there? MI6 changed gear right in the middle of a surveillance operation. They had a bullet with that unlucky son of a bitch's name on it.
Lucy blew out a breath, and from the corner of her eye, she saw the bodyguards boarding the plane, pulling the door closed behind them.
While he's alive, he's still useful, right? You said we need to know what he knows. Can't interrogate a corpse.
Solomon gave the short nod again.
I am compelled to agree. But in the future, we will need to make sure this kind of incident does not occur again, yes?
Before she could answer, the African's eyes turned colder.
I would not wish to be forced to terminate your employment with Rubicon over another such breach of contract.
No doubt, said Lucy, covering with a sip of bourbon.
The office door opened, and Delancourt returned, a digital pad in his hand.
We'll be taxiing soon, he told them.
Departures confirmed. Lucy glanced at her watch as Delancourt offered the pad to Solomon.
The file?
He asked. The assistant nodded. Procurement were able to get a copy of the salient pages from Dane's jacket.
What's this? His personal records? Said Lucy.
Delancourt shook his head.
Not the whole thing, but we have an asset in the Ministry of Defense's medical department. We were able to get a look at Mark Dane's psychological report.
He nodded to himself.
I think we may have enough here to start building a profile on him.
He looked at Solomon. I took the liberty of forwarding it to our people in Zurich. Lucy put down the glass. The Swiss office had a department staffed by psychologists who did something called extrapolative human analysis. Rubicon used them to plan marketing strategies and stock market analysis, among other things.
So we're going after Dane, then?
Everyone is, said Delancourt with a dry smirk. It's just a question of who gets to him first.
If you ignore the bright orange casing of the blade fish, the propeller looked like a bulky desk fan. In the shallows of the bay, the sea jet's quiet electric motor dragged Mark along behind it at a steady 2 knots, guiding him out beneath the calm surface of the waters. He directed it with twists of his shoulders like a steering wheel, but in the dark, it was easy to go off track. He halted every few minutes to rise up and get his bearings. Mark paused by a vacant mooring buoy and lined himself up on the jade once more. Salt water collecting from his snorkel swilled in his mouth and he spat it out through clenched teeth. The drawstring bag on his back felt heavier and he frowned, pulling it tighter over the black T-shirt plastered to his chest. He had no wetsuit, no fins, just the shirt and dive shorts, figuring it would be better to look like an errant tourist. Being in the water always made him feel calmer somehow, like the waves dragged away the tension in him. He bobbed there, watching the yacht, and for the first time he saw movement. A bulky outline passed behind a closed curtain, but it was hard to pick out any detail. He listened, hearing nothing but the slap of water against the hull of the jade and the murmur of music on the wind from the island. He pushed away from the buoy, angling the bladefish to carry him down, and something moved at the back of the boat, out of sync with the rise and fall of the yacht, low against the waterline. Dialing down the sea jet speed, Mark took a deep breath and slipped under the surface, making his approach as close as he dared. When he was 10 feet from the dive platform at the aft, he came up slow and steady without a ripple. There was another boat concealed from line of sight from the shore by the jade's hull. Featureless and matte black, it rolled gently in the slight swell. A nylon cable tethered it
to a temporary suction cup cleat attached to the yacht. The other boat was a semi-rigid inflatable, like the Zodiacs, used by the military. Big enough for five men, it was the craft of choice for anyone wanting to make a covert insertion by water. It was the last thing he had expected to see, and Mark knew for sure that the inflatable had not been there before sunset. Was Novakovich meeting someone out here, he wondered, or is this an escape route? There was movement above him, the shuffle of deck shoes on wood, and Mark drifted into the shadow cast by the jade, floating between the yacht and the smaller craft. He strained to listen and heard a scraping like something being dragged. In the next second, there was the cough of a silenced weapon, and from out of nowhere, a man in short-sleeved tropical whites fell overboard and hit the water, an arm's length from Mark's face. The man turned in the swell, and his head lolled, coming around to look blankly at Mark. He had a small entry wound in the soft flesh of his neck, and a halo of bright blood, staining a shirt with a kind of faux gold braid that rich men with yachts like to make their crews wear. The dead man slowly sank under the surface and vanished from sight. 12. For long moments, Mark willed himself to become a ghost in the water, his breath held in his chest as the seconds ticked by. He didn't dare look up for fear that he might meet the gaze of the crewman's killer. There was a faint creak from the decking, and somewhere deeper inside the boat, the muffled noise of delicate glass breaking. The shooter was gone from the rail overhead, but there was no way to know for how long. He had to move fast. Mark pushed to the rear of the jade, where dive steps extended outwards into the water. Dumping the bladefish in a shadowed corner of the gunwale, he climbed aboard the yacht in a low, careful crouch. Seawater trickled off his shoulders in steady drops, and he moved slowly, planting each foot as if he were walking through a minefield. Tanya Kirin lay on her back on the deck before him, her head facing away, clothed in a floral print shift dress that spread out around her immaculately tanned legs. She'd been carrying a champagne flute when she fell, and the broken stem of it was still clutched in her hand. Mark saw the black pit of the entry wound where the bottom of Tanya's jaw connected with her throat. His stomach tightened as he realized that the pool of shadows haloing the woman was a puddle of blood and brain matter. It brought him up sharp. Poring over his laptop in Camden, he got used to the idea of seeing the flighty young model as nothing more than a vector of information. Now here she was. Life snuffed out because she hadn't paid attention to the security settings on a messaging website. Tanya had likely been the first to die. Mark glanced over his shoulder at the dive steps. Her assassin had come up the same way, weapon drawn, as she unwittingly wandered out to finish her glass of Tattinger. Peering past the body, open doors led into the Jade's gym, and there Mark glimpsed a second figure in crewman's whites, slumped against an exercise bike. Suddenly, his first impression that Novakovich was planning to flee seemed way off. He pulled the Glock from his waterproof bag and held the pistol close to his thigh. But the last thing he wanted to do was use it. A gunshot out here would not only carry clear across the bay, but more importantly, it would alert the killers on board the Jade. And there were killers, plural. A lone assassin would have followed Mark's approach and swum to the yacht. The presence of the Zodiac meant a team sweeping the boat, executing everyone they came across. No witnesses, no survivors. Mark paused by Tanya's corpse and touched the skin of her neck, still warm. Closer to her, he could smell perfume and the tang of spent cordite. His plan of action was in tatters. He hadn't anticipated this, but now it seemed obvious. The people behind the Palomino were cleaning house, chasing down all the loose ends. Just as he feared, they had followed the same chains of data to Sicily and got here before him. He glanced back at the sea, contemplating the fallout if he abandoned his mission and fled.
Where the hell can I go?
Each second wasted was a second closer to losing everything. His fingers tightened around the grip of the Glock. Novakovich was the only lead he had. There was a chance the accountant was still alive. Mark reasoned it through. If Dima was already a corpse, then the Jade would be a ghost ship. Soft footfalls thumped on the deck above his head. They were moving forward toward the flying bridge, starting at the top, working their way toward the keel. Mark backtracked through the gym and found one of the stairwells that dropped down to the lower level. He froze as a shadow passed by on the other side of the glass doors. The figure was clad head to toe in the same kind of matte black tactical gear utilized by the MI6 op teams. His head was hidden behind a mesh balaclava and clumsy night vision goggles that gave the shooter a bug-eyed aspect. Mark recognized the long, heavy frame of the pistol in the man's hand. A silenced Mark 23 semi-automatic. The same kind of weapon favored by American SOCOM operatives. He had no desire to see the gun up close, however, and when the shooter turned away to look to the stern, Mark slipped down the stairwell and moved as fast as he dared past the doors of the passenger deck. At each compartment, he paused for a count of three, holding his breath to listen. Nothing. Amidships, he came across an open door and used the muzzle of the Glock to nudge the gap a little wider. He swept left and right, finding no threats. The well-appointed room was in some disarray. A tea service lay upended where it had been knocked to the floor. On the big plasma TV that dominated one wall, a movie was freeze-framed in mid-flow. The characters on screen caught shouting at one another. The pause icon blinking in the corner of the display. The remote was on the carpet where it had fallen. Mark examined it, following the trail of disruption around the room. This was Dima's cabin, the largest on the yacht. He must have heard something, Mark reasoned. Paused the movie, stopped to listen. What had come next? A shot? A cry of alarm? It had been enough to send the accountant running, tipping over the tea, heedless of the mess. Dima was still alive because he hadn't tried to get off the yacht. He'd gone forward, deeper into the hull. Killing time in the departure lounge at Gatwick, Mark had memorized the Jade's original internal schematics from a website for boating enthusiasts, and now he ran through them in his mind's eye. Where would Novakovich go to ground? He played a hunch. The yacht's galley was white plastic and brushed steel, and the only light came from the soft blue glow of a giant refrigerator. There were shadows everywhere and plenty of places to hide. Panning the pistol, Mark reached out a hand to feel for a light switch and felt a sudden pain in the small of his back. He flinched, reflexively, tried to turn, and for his trouble, got the glinting length of a Sabatier chef's knife pressed to his throat. A man in expensive-looking cotton slacks and an unbuttoned shirt confronted him. His pug face filmed with sweat and set with fear. Dima Novakovich, very much alive and balancing on the edge of open panic.
Put the gun on the table, motherfucker, he hissed. I'll open you up.
Mark felt the tip of the kitchen knife nick the side of his chin, and he kept very still, raising the Glock and taking care to show he had his finger off the trigger.
I'm not one of them.
Shit, Novakovich retorted.
Give me the gun. I slit your throat.
Dima, listen to me.
Using his first name actually startled the Lithuanian, and he blinked. Mark pressed on.
I'm here to get you out. They're upstairs. They'll find us.
The broker needed the grip of the blade. He wasn't a killer. According to Interpol's records, Novakovich only made money off selling weapons, never using them himself. Mark kept eye contact with the other man. Each second that he wasn't stabbing him, Dima was losing the momentum to carry out his threat.
Who sent you? He demanded. British intelligence,
Mark lied. I'm a friend of Samantha Green. Mentioning Sam's real identity was the only card he had to play. He was taking a chance that she had given Novakovic her real name in their dealings. When the man backed off a few steps, he knew his gamble had paid off.
Where? Novakovic looked around. She is here?
Mark blew out a breath and rubbed at the new cut on his chin. He doesn't know about the freighter. That made sense. It had only been days since the incident in Dunkirk, and if Novakovic was on the run from his Combine Masters, he'd be out of the loop. We got wind of this, Mark went on, making it up as he went. Sam sent me. For an instant, an almost childlike look of relief crossed the broker's pale Slavic features. On some level, Dima was so terrified that he wanted it to be true. He needed to be convinced that someone had come to rescue him. But then it passed and he became suspicious again.
Just you?
Novakovic sized him up and frowned.
Yeah. I don't believe you.
The broker pulled a gold-plated iPhone from his pocket and pressed it into Mark's grip.
Call her. I want to talk to her.
Don't be stupid, Mark snapped, improvising on the fly with a half-truth.
Zero profile, mate. Sam said radio silence.
He pressed on before the man could question his story. The others are ashore. Look, you want to play 20 questions or you want to get off this boat?
What I want is to...
Novakovic stopped short as a low, gurgling rumble shuddered through the floor beneath their feet. Kitchen utensils chimed against one another as the jade set slowly into motion. Pocketing the phone in case Novakovic decided to make the call himself, Mark held up a hand to wave him back and peered out into the corridor. Through one of the portholes across the way, he saw the Capo Tarmina headland slipping away as the yacht retreated from its moorings. The hit team had raised the anchor and were taking the jade out to sea, into the deeper waters of the Med. Once they were far enough out, it would be easy to scuttle the boat and let it sink without a trace. He turned back. Time to go. I've got a secure location on the island. We can, debrief you there. Mark had no idea how he was going to keep up the fiction that he was still an active MI6 officer, but right now he had to deal with what was in front of him. Is there another way off this thing? Novakovic emerged behind him and pointed down the corridor, no longer questioning the narrative.
Garage. I have a launch. Jet skis.
He shook his head.
But we can't go yet. I have to get something.
Mark heard footfalls on the deck directly above his head.
No time, he whispered. Come on.
The broker gestured with the knife.
Not going without it.
He set off down a narrow side passage. Mark swore under his breath and followed. Nothing about this was going as he had hoped. The short corridor ended in what appeared to be a bulkhead panel, but Novakovic fumbled at a plate in the deck and slid it back to reveal a numerical keypad. He punched in a string of digits and the bulkhead popped open on concealed hinges. The broker pushed it open and Mark caught a draft of dry, machine-chilled air and the faint ozone smell of electronics. Inside the hidden compartment was a pillar of black and silver that went from floor to ceiling. Webs of thick yellow data cables emerged from the back of it, and constellations of blinking green lights flickered up and down the surface of the device.
You've got your own server, muttered Mark, more to himself than to Novakovic. Of course you have.
It made sense. The broker's clients were, after all, people of private and dangerous natures, and the details of their business could never be entrusted to a conventional data store. By keeping his own computer server in a mobile location, isolated from the internet until it needed to be connected by satellite, Novakovic could offer security to any kind of illicit transaction. In effect, he was carrying his own little pocket of the dark net around with him.
They punch holes in the hull, Novakovic was saying, as he used the Sabatier to work at a set of latches in the server stack.
Sink my jade. The only way to obliterate all this.
He gave a bitter smile.
Seawater is not kind to circuits.
He seemed a lot more upset about the loss of his yacht than the woman lying dead on the stern deck, or his executed employees. Mark said nothing. He didn't need to like the man. He only needed what Novakovich knew about the rat hiding inside MI6. With a snap of connectors, a thick module the size of a hardcover book came free in the broker's hand, and he clutched it like it was his firstborn child, discarding the knife. Mark recognized the shape of a military-grade hard drive. It looked like one of the heavy-duty models used by the Russian Navy aboard their nuclear submarines, tempest-shielded to resist electromagnetic pulses, fireproof and waterproof.
"This is my passport, you understand," Novakovich told him. "You take me to a safe place. This will tell you what you want to know."
He pushed past Mark and made his way back up the side passage.
"We go now."
Mark scowled. He reached for the other man's arm, trying to pull him back, and missed.
"Wait, it's not safe."
But Novakovich wasn't listening. The broker emerged into the corridor, running the length of the passenger deck, and almost collided with a stealth-suited gunman moving down toward them. There was nothing Mark could do to stop what happened next. The shooter flipped up his weapon and opened fire without a flicker of hesitation. The short barrel MP9 submachine gun released a cluster of silenced rounds that ran up Novakovich's body, some of the bullets sparking off the case of the hard drive. Novakovich cried out and crumpled backward with a crash. The gunman pivoted sharply at the corner of the passage and turned the muzzle of the MP9 toward Mark. His night vision goggles would easily render the space visible, and there was no cover at all. Mark took the offensive and attacked as the weapon came toward him. With the Glock in his fist, he brought the heavy butt of the pistol across, smashing it into the lenses of the gunman's NVG rig with such violence that broken shards were driven into the shooter's cheek and eyes. The gunman jerked the MP9's trigger, but the shots went wide, chugging into the wall and the ceiling of the corridor as the magazine emptied. Mark pushed forward with all his remaining impetus and brought up his knee into the gunman's crotch, forcing him back. Blinded and flailing, the shooter struck out with the MP9 and used it to club him in the head. Mark's ears rang and he lost his momentum, almost stumbling over Novakovich, who lay choking on the richly carpeted floor. With a grunt, the gunman ripped off the goggles and fumbled for the hilt of a wicked-looking combat knife, swearing under his breath. Mark remembered the moment on the tower block roof in London. But this time, there would be no mystery shot, no intervention from out of the darkness. He felt no doubt as he brought up the Glock and fired twice, putting both rounds through the other man's sternum at close range. In the close confines of the corridor, the sound of the gun's discharge was sharp and high, like firecrackers. The gunman went down and was still. At his feet, Novakovich drooled dark arterial blood, his body shaking as it went into shock. His eyes lost focus as Mark crouched beside him. The broker's labored breaths became wet, strangled, and then silent. He had to wrench the hard drive from the dead man's grip, and he took off running toward the bow as footsteps clattered down the stairwell behind him. Mark pointed the Glock backward and fired blindly, sending more shots into the dark. He shouldered open the door to the Jade's garage and kicked it shut behind him. Sparks flared at the gap as more silenced rounds came back in return. Mark's heart hammered as he pushed past a small motorboat hanging from its rig and found the sloped hatch in the wall of the starboard hull. A T-shaped switch that was set in a recess, colored bright hazard orange, with a panel of text next to it that said, "Do not open at sea," in 5 different languages. He wrenched it downward, and the wall creased, big metal slats retreating away like folding sheets of paper. The hard drive went into the drawstring bag as he cast around, every second of delay screaming at him to move. Novakovich's jet skis sat on aluminium rails designed to act as slipways.
Mark spent another bullet blowing open the locker on the wall holding the starter keys and then rushed back to the nearest wet bike, ripping off the bungee cords, holding it in place. Another spray of automatic fire rattled against the metal hatch, and he knew that the shooters would be on him any moment. Mark vaulted into the saddle and shoved the jet ski forward with his body weight. He felt it start to move as he jammed the starter key home, yanked the choke and thumbed the ignition. If the engine didn't turn over, then he was most certainly dead. Mercifully, the Kawasaki grumbled into life as it slid down the rail, and there was a brief, stomach-turning lurch before the jet ski hit the water and a surge of low surf slapped into Mark's chest. He landed badly and almost fell out of the saddle right there, but one hand gripped the throttle, held tight, and the Kawasaki bounced back up to the surface of the waves, nose pointing away from the Jade. Leaning low over the handlebars, Mark gunned the motor, and the jet ski shot away. For a second time, he blind-fired over his shoulder, waving the Glock in the direction of the open hatchway. The throttle vibrated under his fingers, and he leaned in to a series of S-turns back in the direction of the shoreline. He heard the buzz of bullets cutting the air around him, but then the noise was lost in the hiss of the waves and the roar of the Kawasaki's engine. Mark hugged the machine, willing it to go faster.
Ellis let the MP9's muzzle drop and swore as he ejected a spent magazine and tossed it into the water, mechanically replacing it with a fresh load from the pouches on his tactical vest. Cruz came up behind him, an eternally blank expression visible across the Brazilian's swarthy features. Hayes killed the primary, but Hayes is dead.
"Who the fuck was that?"
Ellis demanded, ignoring the other man's words.
"Every bugger on this bud was accounted for. Who was this deuce?"
His native Afrikaner accent always grew thick whenever he lost his temper. He slapped at the radio tab on his neck.
"Deep, bring this thing around. We've got a runner."
There was a momentary pause before the American answered.
"Did you hit him?"
The walkie-talkie scrambler made the channel tinny. "This boat doesn't exactly turn on a dime. He'll be ashore before we catch up. Did you hit the runner over?"
"I don't reckon."
Ellis ground out the words, irritated by the admission that he had burned through a mag with nothing to show for it.
"Who was? Is Novakovic dead?"
Teep cut him off before he could go on. "Primary is dead," repeated Cruz. "Hayes, too." There was a dismissive tutting noise. "Put Hayes in the Zodiac, then prep the charges below the waterline. Ellis, get his camera and bring it up here." Teep locked the Jade's helm on automatic and snatched up a pair of binoculars from a storage bin at the side of the flying bridge. He looked across the stern, and the bulky optics brought the bay of Taormina into sharp focus. It was difficult to pick out the jet ski's wake among all the light pollution spilling from the town even at this hour. If he'd had a sniper rifle and a targeting steer, it might have been possible to kill the man before he made it to the island, but none of the team had anything larger than a submachine gun. Fortunately, Teep's employers had planned ahead. They had an option for just such a problem. He replaced the binoculars and fished a burner cell phone from a pocket, dialing a number from memory. The call connected on the second ring.
"See?"
"Problem," he explained. "Can you find something for me?" The voice on the other end of the line switched to English.
"Where?"
"Coming ashore in the bay, any moment now." Teep glanced up as Ellis came up the ramp to the flying bridge. "Probably based somewhere local. I'll get you a picture."
"Okay."
The call ended, and Teep weighed the phone in his hand. Ellis offered a collection of cables and components to the other man. One device was a commercial digital video player. A cable ran from it to a compact brick of black, impact-resistant plastic that sported a gimbal-mounted digital camera at one end. No larger than a AA battery, the low-light camera was small enough to fit in the pocket of a tactical vest, and the memory pack could record hours of footage. Each member of the kill team had a similar unit on them, to keep them honest. Ellis was also carrying something that looked like a portable fan.
"Found this, lying on the sun deck," he explained. "That's how the bugger got out here."
Teep said nothing. Using the tablet to access the camera, spinning through the killer's eye view until he came to the moment when Hayes had almost collided with Novakovic. He watched Hayes dispatch the broker, but it took two back-and-forth replays for him to isolate a frame of video showing the face of the man who had shot dead the other operative. "This him?" He showed a grey-green low-light image of a washed-out face, framed by light-coloured hair caught in the middle of grim exertion.
"Could be," Ellis was sullen.
He didn't like being party to mistakes.
"Yeah."
Teep captured the image, then slipped the cable into a port on the phone. Within moments, the picture was sent to two distinct destinations. The first was Faso, the watcher he had left on the island. The second was the first link in a chain of blind digital relays that would eventually channel the still to someone who could put a name to the face. Mark ditched the jet ski on the pebbled beach and threw the key into the surf. The faint notes of soft piano music filtering down from the terraces of the San Domenico Palace Hotel up above were a stark counterpoint to the drumming of his heart in his ears. He ran toward the steep path leading up the cliffside and into the town. A short way up, beneath the thin trees clinging to the rocks, he dragged the dark tracksuit out of his waterproof bag and pulled it on over his wet swim gear. Swallowed up by the warm night, Mark looked back over the bay and out to sea. There was nothing to indicate that the Jade had ever been there. The hard drive was bulky and awkward on his back, and he felt hyperconscious of its weight and the potential of the data it contained. As an afterthought, he opened the neck of the drawstring backpack and fished out the dead man's cell phone, crackling open the casing with his thumbnail. Mark pulled the device's battery so it couldn't be used to track him, and tossed it back in. He couldn't make out anyone following him, so Mark made the ascent up the long and winding path, moderating his pace so he wouldn't be winded by the time he reached the narrow road at the top of the cliff. Deliberately, he took a long, roundabout route, going away from the Monte Taro Hotel, up towards the Corso Umberto, the main thoroughfare through the town. The medieval streets came in close and offered plenty of shady alcoves. Mark picked his way along them, diverting down cobbled alleyways as he cut back in a loop, in the direction of the parkland at the Villa Comunale. Finally, he followed a group of boisterous German tourists making their way back to the hotel and slipped in behind them, crossing the Tauro's foyer while they dithered and chatted. Mark was reaching for the door to his room when some unnamed instinct stilled him in his tracks. Outwardly, nothing was amiss, but after a night of seeing every part of his plans come apart, he was suddenly seized by the certainty that something wasn't right. Holding his breath, Mark pressed against the wall and leaned as close to the door as he dared, straining to hear. For long minutes, nothing. He started to wonder what he would do if one of the hotel staff appeared. Then, very distinctly, he heard the sound of movement on the other side of the door, the creak of the wicker chair out by the balcony, shifting under someone's weight. The blood drained from his face. All the while he had been burning off time, taking the long way back to the hotel, thinking he was being clever. But these people had found him anyway. Was there someone like the German assassin waiting in there for him, a silenced gun aimed at the door? The chair creaked again, and he knew for certain. Silently, Mark drew back from the door, retreating away. Strangely, he felt partly vindicated for his own paranoia. Before setting off to the Jade, his last act had been to secrete his day pack in a hide outside his hotel room, instead of stowing it in the room safe, which was hardly secure in itself. He'd opted for a more basic option. There was a maintenance closet off the corridor with a huge ceiling. Mark stood on tiptoe to dislodge a tire with his fingers and found the day pack's strap hanging behind it, exactly where he had left it. He grabbed it and fled. Instead of going up the rise toward the town, he retreated back down the small slip road that served the hotel, following the curve around the hillside toward the beaches. With his hood up and a shemagh taken from Sam's go-bag around his face, Mark avoided the gaze of the Monte Toro's security cameras and scrambled over a wall a few meters further on, climbing around a dusty fiberboard sign on scaffold poles, dragging the backpack behind him. The sign sported a sun-bleached picture of idyllic three-story beachside apartments and text promising the completion of construction the previous year. On the other side of the wall was the debris of a forsaken construction site, overgrown by the march of the local greenery. The plot sported the frames of the promised apartment, but little else. The unfinished holiday homes resembled something a patient but unimaginative child might have made out of building bricks. Breeze block cubes open to the air in many places where walls had not been added. The air was musty, with the smell of animal urine and neglect. The ground littered with windblown trash and dead leaves. Mark slipped into the nearest of the skeletal buildings and worked his way to the uppermost floor, through the gaps where staircases would have eventually been installed. The boom and bust in the European construction industry over the last decade had left dozens of sites like this, scattered around the holiday resorts of the Mediterranean, snapped up by speculators unable to complete contracts or sold on in a hostile marketplace. The apartments were out of the way here, out of sight from Taormina, forgotten and isolated. A good bolt hole and well placed to watch the hotel. It was what Mark needed, a place where he could rest and think on his next move. Too much of what was happening to him was reactive, forced onto him by the actions of people who wanted him dead. If he was going to get ahead of the curve, that had to change. He found a corner of the unfinished building, a space that probably would have been a well-appointed bathroom had the Euro crash never happened. He put on his last change of clean clothes, and, making certain that there was no way any light would be seen from the streets above, he booted up his laptop. The hard drive sat on the floor. It was an ugly object, all sharp edges and steel plates. Numerous ports and jack sockets dotted the flanks of it, many of them non-standard sizes deliberately chosen by the Soviet military to make it difficult for anyone without the correct gear to access the contents. Difficult, Mark reflected, but not impossible. He set a suite of high-level intrusion programs to work on the device, letting them probe its firewalls for weaknesses. It would take hours for the software to map the whole scope of the drive's memory, like a scout circling an ancient fortress in search of loose stones in the walls. Mark could only sit back and watch the slow, inexorable motion of a progress bar across the screen. One at a time, feeling the tightness in his muscles, he marched bullets into the magazine of the Glock and waited for the dawn.